next case is number 2012-1299, Sharp Electronics v. Army. Mr. Whibble, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Weibel.
Okay.
May it please the Court, Andrew Weibel, the law firm of Cohen Moore, representing contractor Sharp Electronics Corporation. This appeal concerns the Armed Service Board of Contract Appeals' interpretation and application of FAR subpart 8.406-6, and particularly the distinction that we will draw between disputes under the Contractors Dispute Act that pertain to the performance of an order issued pursuant to a federal supply schedule contract.
Most of these disputes, counsel, are going to relate to the delivery contract, but they're also going to relate to the underlying CSA contract. What are we supposed to do?
Well, I think that, first of all, that conclusion, I think, is the takeaway from the recent GPSI decision that we supplemented, that was issued just this past September. And that is really that you can't analyze or consider performance issues without relation to the contract. And in a GSA schedule contract situation, the bulk of that contract is going to be the schedule contract.
Well, that may be, but I mean, the problem that we have is in construing this disputes clause. And what it says is the ordering contract hours so shall refer all disputes that relate to the contract terms and conditions of this to the scheduling contracting officer for resolution. So if I understand what that's saying, it's saying that if there's a dispute that relates to the scheduling contract terms and conditions, it has to go to the contracting officer for GSA. Am I misreading that?
I don't think you're misreading that, but I think that the real question is what exactly did the FAR Council mean with that term relate to the terms and conditions? As I noted, the rule was amended in 2002. Prior to that amendment, all disputes had to be referred
to the GSA.
Correct. So we presume that the change was to have some meaning. If you can't analyze a performance question without implicating the terms and conditions of the contract.
I want to come back to the question that the presiding judge asked, which I think is one we need to get to. But the short before I get there is the way they put this regulation together, they said, well, if you have a performance problem, right, then you take that to the DO, the delivery contract officer, and that person can either decide himself or he can ship it over to GSA.
Correct.
So all of the problems that you wanted not to go to GSA, that used to go there, that deal with performance, this very regulation allows it to continue to happen. Crazy. But get to the presiding judge's point. What do the words terms and conditions mean?
Well, I think if they're to have any practical import, that they have to be questions that arise independent of the particular facts and circumstances relating to performance. And a perfect example of that is the first Sharp decision that the ASBCA decided in 2004.
Other than performance, I have a hard time reading it that way. It seems to me that what it means is if you need to construe the scheduled contract, it has to go to the GSA contracting officer.
I would submit, Your Honor, respectfully, that is far too broad a reading of that. It would essentially rob the rule of any practical meaning. As the GPSI case points out, you can't determine performance issues without reference to you know, without reading and construing the contract.
Well, reading it may be one thing. Construing it may be another. One way to look at it would be to think, if the decision will have implications not just for this dispute, but for any current and future contracts that might arise under the base, what I'll call the base contract terms and conditions, if it would have universal impact, then you might assume it should go to the GSA officer.
And I think that's correct. And that was the point I was trying to make, perhaps inartfully. You know, what we're talking about are questions that arise independently of this particular case. You're talking about ambiguities in the base contract. You're talking about questions of validity in the base contract. These are fundamental issues for which the ordering agency has no real position to make a decision. I mean, we're talking about issues relating to formation of base contract. The ordering agency wasn't a party to that.
Even if we assume that the construction of this clause means that it only goes to the GSA if there's a need to construe a provision of the base contract, aren't we in that situation here, that there needs to be a construction of the termination provision of the base contract?
I would submit you only need to do that if the dispute challenges the interpretation of the particular provision. And I don't think that that's what occurred in this case.
I think I need to understand a little bit better what your theory is here. Do I understand correctly that you're not challenging the ability of the Army to enter into a contract with you for less than an option year?
In theory, no. I would think that the contractor may enter into an accord of satisfaction, or the contractor may waive the termination provisions. But I think that the facts and circumstances need to support that finding.
I don't really understand that answer. What I understood happened was that the government had an option period of a year. They could have exercised the option period. They did not exercise the option period. Do you agree with that?
I would agree with that.
So they instead entered into a contract with your client for a six-month additional period, correct?
That is correct. I guess I would take a step back. The option that you were discussing is part of the contract. So we have, and I realize that it's framed in terms of an option, but you have to read that option in conjunction with the terms of the base contract.
Can we look, we're talking about lease term.
Correct.
Under the GSA base contract, there's nothing in there about options. It says the lease term can't exceed 36 months for desktops or 60 months for consoles.
Correct.
So as far as GSA is concerned, that's the length of the contract is stated right there. GSA doesn't care whether you want to have a three-year contract, you know, for consoles, or, you know, five-year contract, or to have a base year and option years.
Well, I believe the way that the base contract is written is that you have to have a minimum of 36 and a maximum of 60.
Oh, yeah, I understand.
And that the lease term, the total lease term is determined by
the base
order that is placed.
By the ordering contract.
Right. And in this case, they placed a four-year contract. So that third option year, with the fourth year of the lease, that is still part of the original contract that was let in year one. And that's why they have to, you know, they're presumed to need to continue to lease that for all 48 months. They didn't do that here. Now, I understood your question to be asking, is there any set of circumstances where they could do that and not have the termination apply? And I would say yes. We don't think that happened in this case.
Come back to whether or not, and I think it's very important for us to know whether or not you contest the legitimacy of the shortened option period. Because in your brief to the Armed Services Contract Board, you contended that you weren't bound by that. you made an argument that it really wasn't your intent to limit yourself to the 6 months of performance. It was a convenience for the government, something like that. Now, come back to the question that the presiding judge posed. We have in the record Mod 11 that's a bilateral modification. How do we treat that? Is that a valid contract whereby you agreed to a performance of shorter than a year?
Well,
yes or no?
That's the question for the board to decide.
I'm asking you, what's the answer?
I would say that it is valid insofar as it stands, but you have to read it in context of the base contract.
You're not helping me. If it's correct that there's no question but what you bound yourself to a performance period shorter than a year, bound yourself and cannot complain about it.
Well, I don't agree with that.
Well, then, what is your basis for complaining? And why? And you didn't, in your brief to us, you didn't say that.
Well, because I don't believe that's the issue. The issue is, what is the nature of the dispute?
The board said, look what we've got here. We've got a situation where the government had a right, if it wanted to, just to chop the last year off entirely. It was their option. They said, we can't go a full year. So we're either going to chop you off or we'll give you a half year, your choice. And you said, thanks a bunch, we want the half year. And so the way the board looked at that is to say, you unilaterally bound yourself to a period of performance of 6 months. And yet you're still arguing that the termination provision of the GSA contract applies to this. It was saying, doesn't GSA have to be the one to decide whether they will allow the benefits of an early termination to apply in a circumstance where there has been no early termination? That was, to me, the way they were framing the question. And so, unless you can get off the hook...
I think we get off the hook by challenging the characterization that what we did would bind ourselves to a lesser term.
Well, where did you make that argument in your brief?
Well,
I know you made your argument somehow into the Armed Services contract.
I believe that goes to the merits of the case.
You should have bound yourself to a six-month term. You're not disputing that, are you?
I'm saying that we agreed to the contract, but I don't think
you
that
agreed
means
to a six-month term. Whatever the consequences of that might be, you agreed to a six-month term, right?
Our agent signed the contract, yes. The question is, what is the legal significance of that? Is that in accordance with that?
You're not contending that the government exercised the full option year, right?
I am not contending that.
Okay. So this seems to be an agreement that's outside of the option provision whereby the parties agree to extend the contract for a six-month additional. And I understand your contention to be, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that that led to a early termination claim.
Correct. The termination says, if the government terminates the contract before the end of the full lease term, before the 48 months expire, then the contractor is entitled to early termination charges. Now, the fact that we signed a delivery order for less than a full year raises the question of, did we waive that?
Well, you're not contending, are you, that the government had the obligation to exercise the options, are you?
It was not obligated to, but the way the base contract is drafted, it has limited circumstances which allow it to not exercise that option without incurring the termination cost.
And those limited circumstances are?
If the activity is discontinued, if there are no appropriations made to the activity.
So you're saying that apart from those circumstances, they had to exercise the option?
Yes.
Okay. That sounds sort of like a construction of the base contract.
Well, but I submit that that's not really what the issue in this case was. The issue was, what was the legal effect of Sharp signing the delivery order for less than the full year on the final option? And I think that you can't resolve that without looking at what took place between the parties in executing that six-month PO, what took place in the 3 months that followed that. They then issued a second mod, mod 12. You know, what does all this mean? Was there a waiver? Was there an accord and satisfaction? You know, if the answer to that is no, then I think the termination clause applies. It's mechanical. I don't think there's any dispute as to what the termination clause means, how it operates, if unambiguous.
Okay, I think we're out of time. We'll give you 2 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Jabour, is that pronounced correctly?
Good morning, may it please the Court. I want to cover two issues today, and the first is the issue that this Court has discussed with Mr. Weibel, which is, does this dispute relate to the terms and conditions of the schedule contract, or does it relate to performance of the delivery order? And then the second issue is, what are the jurisdictional implications of the answer to that first question?
I take it that you probably would agree that this case involves both the construction of the base contract and the purchase order, right? And it's certainly Mod 11 of that.
That's correct. I don't think there's any dispute.
And is your position that if in any respect you have to construe the base contract, that it has to go to the GSA contracting officer?
If there's a legal construction issue of the terms and conditions of the base contract, then yes, it has to.
Even though there are performance issues and constructions of the purchase order and all that, but if there's any part of it, you say, that involves the construction of the base contract, it has to go to GSA.
That's correct. If there's a legal interpretation issue, and the reason, then it does need to go to GSA, and the reason that this Court highlighted with Mr. Weibel is really the appropriate one, which is that if there's an issue that's going to be affecting multiple agencies under this scheduled contract, then GSA should be issuing uniform legal interpretations of the schedule contract.
But we don't know whether it will uniformly affect other contracts until we know what the interpretation of the base contract has to be in order to resolve this particular conflict. In other words, the trigger for this conflict does not begin in the base contract. The trigger for this conflict comes out of the way in which they wrote the delivery order and then the way in which they agreed to change the delivery order. We don't yet know whether any of that will actually implicate a particular construction or change in the base contract. So we don't yet know whether there's going to be implications for the entire contracting world of GSA. Why shouldn't we read, I think we would all agree that 8.406-6 is probably a classic example of bad drafting. But let's try to make what we can out of it. Why shouldn't we read B, sub B, to say, the ordering activity contracting officer shall refer all disputes that relate solely to the contract terms and conditions to the schedule contracting officer for resolution under the disputes clause of the contract, and notify the schedule contractor of the referral. That is to say, shouldn't the GSA contracting officer, who doesn't have any first-hand knowledge of what's going on in the actual delivery contracts, shouldn't that officer be concerned only when there is a real question about the underlying contract?
I agree with Your Honor, but I think that proposal becomes a little bit difficult to administer in that there can only be one contracting officer's final decision. So in other words,
you're agreeing that the word only should be read in there?
No, I apologize if I made it sound like I was agreeing with that. That was not what I was agreeing with. I was simply saying that there can only be one contracting officer's final decision. And so you can't separate out a dispute that calls for, or an issue that calls for a legal interpretation of the schedule contract from factual issues. They're all part of the same dispute. You can't have, for instance, the GSA contracting officer issuing a decision only regarding legal interpretation questions, and then the Army contracting officer issuing a separate contracting officer's final decision. There can only be one. So if there are any legal interpretation issues, then it's incumbent on the GSA to decide the dispute.
But would that be almost every dispute, because the delivery contract builds on the underlying base contract as a matter of law? And I thought this regulation was designed to relieve the GSA contracting officer having to deal with every dispute that comes along, and it creates a system under which the ordering activity contracting officer may issue final decisions on disputes arising from performance of the order. This is clearly a dispute arising from performance of the order. It may also be a dispute involving the terms of the underlying base contract. But the regulation says on disputes arising from performance of the order. He can refer the dispute to the schedule contracting officer, which seems, as I think Judge Clevenger noted or one of the other judges noted, seems to undercut the whole point of the exercise, but that's besides the point. The ordering activity contracting officer shall notify the schedule contracting officer promptly of any final decision. Well, that suggests that the ordering activity contracting officer can make a final decision that has implications for the schedule contracting officer, and then notify him that that's what he's done. How do you understand this relationship to actually work?
Well, my understanding is that the relationship is that typically a contractor is going to go to their ordering activity contracting officer first.
As he did here, yes.
Right, exactly. Just that's who they're most familiar with. That's their point of contact. They're going to go to that person first.
So they did the right thing in going there to begin.
I'm not going to make a judgment about whether or not they did the right thing.
That's the way the world works.
That's typically the way it'll work. Okay. We're not going to pin you down on this particular. Go ahead.
And then, ordinarily, the disputes, I would think in many instances, actually do only concern facts of performance. For instance, in this case, there could have been a dispute. There wasn't, but there could have been a dispute that Sharp delivered the right copiers, that they deliver them on time. These are solely performance issues. Just like in GTSI, the dispute was, did the agency have sufficient funds? Surely a fact issue. In Spectrum, did they perform 24/7? Were they required under the delivery order to perform 24/7? Again, solely a fact issue. There are cases, though, and this is one of them, where the appellant, Sharp, has invoked a legal interpretation question.
Okay, in a nutshell, what is the dispute pertaining to the terms and conditions of the scheduled contract?
Well, as Sharp has framed it,
Tell me what it is.
Well, their dispute is that they say that the terms...
What's the GSA contracting officer going to have to decide? What's the question?
Does the discontinuance provision entitle Sharp to termination charges where there's been a bilateral modification of the option period? That's the dispute. If the parties bilaterally agree to modify the term of their delivery order...
Or stated differently, does the early termination clause pertain to a contract that has been terminated voluntarily by the parties?
That has been voluntarily terminated.
Yeah.
Right.
It was terminated because it had an end date.
Right.
I mean, if you said this contract is over on a certain date, it's terminated.
Well, the parties agreed to only partially exercise an option period. I don't know that we phrased it in terms of termination.
So what happens now? If they lose this case, if we were to affirm, are they in a position then to go to the GSA contracting officer and raise this?
Yeah, absolutely. They're not
prohibited. They have 5 years, don't they?
They have 6 years.
And 6 years.
Right, so they're not time barred from doing so. They can go to the GSA contracting officer and seek a decision. And then if they're not satisfied with that decision, they're free to take an appeal to the Court of Federal Claims or the Civilian Board of Contract Appeals.
The way this provision is written, it looks as though the Army contracting officer should have referred the dispute to the GSA contracting officer.
Yeah. Well, what about that?
I agree in the normal course, that's what should happen. But we are confronted here with a situation where there was no action by the Army contracting officer. And
well, the first problem is that when you go to the DO contracting officer, that officer has to decide whether is this one a performance issue or is this an interpretation issue. And, of course, humans being as they are, they can make mistakes. So the DO CO could have said, well, I think this is a performance issue, and it's a no-brainer. I'm not even going to write an opinion. Guy's not entitled to any money. He agreed to end the contract. So he gives him a deemed denial. So there's no assurance in the way this thing is written, especially where the DO contracting officer can ship a performance issue if he wants to the other side, that there'll be any certainty.
No, that's right.
So how do we get certainty? How do we stop this line of cases?
I'm not sure it's easy, but you are correct.
It'd be nice if you, as much in your interest as it is in the interest of contractors and of the court.
No, I understand. And I do think that part of it is that when a contractor is invoking a provision in the schedule contract and is potentially calling for an interpretation of it, which I think if Sharp was honest about his claim, that is what they were doing here. It wasn't the government that was invoking the schedule contract. Look, if we just want to look at Mods 11 and 12 on their own and not even look at the schedule contract, that's obviously perfectly fine with the Army. We're content to stand on Mods 11 and 12 alone. It was Sharp that invoked the terms and conditions of the schedule contract.
I mean, as a matter of laying down a rule of law, is it important? If you say, okay, if you invoke a clause in the schedule contract, you're on the way to the GSA.
No, I think it's more than invoking. I mean, well, I think it's really that
you build up the grounds for an opinion.
Sure, that you're asking for an interpretation of a term or condition of the schedule contract. But look, if there is any doubt, I think the easiest thing to do is to file your claim with the GSA contracting officer if you feel like there could be a legal interpretation issue of the schedule contract.
Well, sure, you can cure all this by filing both places. It's just a matter of a copying machine that copies your claim and puts a different addressee on it, right?
Right.
But the whole notion of duplicating the whole system with two contracting officers being pummeled with this thing and then possibly two appeals going to two different boards seems crazy, doesn't it?
I'm not sure if it's crazy. I do think that...
It's good for lawyers, but who else?
Well, I think that there is a burden on the contractor to analyze his claim and figure out where that claim is supposed to go. And
let's assume in this case he analyzed his claim and said, this is a dispute over the delivery contract because the delivery contract said a full year, we've agreed to make it 6 months, but under the termination clause of the contract, we're entitled to some compensation for that. So he looks at that and he says, well, that's clearly part of our delivery contract, isn't it? And his lawyers say, yeah, that seems to be the case. And we look at the disputes provision, and it says under the disputes clause, the ordering activity contracting officer may do two things. He may either issue a final decision or he may refer the dispute to the scheduled contract. So the lawyer looks at that and says, oh, well, this is easy. We give it to the ordering activity contracting officer because it comes in his bailiwick. If he doesn't think so, if we're wrong, then he'll kick it over. That's a very logical thing for them to do. But your ordering activity contracting officer didn't kick it over. He decided it. Now, he decided it negatively by simply not doing anything. But that's deemed decided. Is there no obligation? Is there no consequence for that?
The consequence is that I agree in these situations where there is a deemed denial, the contractor is left with in a difficult situation. And the solution, if they don't want to go to the ASPCA, is to seek an opinion from the GSA contracting officer whether or not that was a valid deemed denial. But I think it's tricky on the contracting officer's end as well, because as Judge Clevenger pointed out earlier, the contracting officer is under no assurance that even if he or she issues a decision, the Army contracting officer could issue a decision and then Sharp could come back later and say, this concerned the terms and conditions of the schedule contract. We don't think your decision is valid. And that's exactly what happened in Sharp's dispute versus the Navy. the Navy contracting officer issued a decision, and then Sharp came back and said, sorry, we actually don't think you had jurisdiction to issue that decision.
If I understand your position, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, your position is that all disputes that require a construction of the base contract have to go to the GSA, point one. And point two, that this case involves such a dispute because they're saying that the termination provision applies to situations like this, and you say it doesn't, right?
Right, there's a dispute over interpretation, correct. Right, so I think really this, I understand that this regulation may not provide answers in the small segment of cases where there is a potential deemed denial. There can be tricky issues. But even where a contractor, contracting officer does affirmatively issue a decision, there's potential risk in that situation as well. So there are situations that you can envision where both the contractor and the contracting officer are put in difficult predicaments. I think the...
If you were counseling a contractor who said, where do we file, what would you counsel them?
I would counsel them to file at the place where, if they're confident it deals with a performance issue, then go to the ordering activity contracting officer. They're going to be the one...
Deals with a performance issue or deals only with a performance issue?
Deals only with a performance issue. The ordering activity contracting officer will be the one who's best equipped to handle that dispute. Even if there's actually any doubt, I think that's the appropriate way to go. And then if you don't get a decision in 60 days, I think the or referral within 60 days, I think the appropriate thing to do is to reach out to the GSA contracting officer.
So your problem is almost all performance issues ultimately relate to a particular clause in the contract.
Yeah.
So I have a performance, did you use the right color paint? Did you do it on time? So there's a contract, everything's done pursuant to the contract. So when there's a performance dispute, it relates at least to the contract that is that the contracting CO put out. And then there's this
right.
overarching GSA contract that matches up almost every key term. It's just not as detailed.
Right. I think, but we call upon, you know, this is kind of the classic legal factual distinction. What is a legal dispute and what is a factual dispute? And in litigation, lawyers are called to make these judgments all the time. But I think the bottom line is there is a simple way forward. That simple way forward is simply file with your ordering agency contracting officer. Normally there will be a referral or there will be a decision.
The factual dispute won't work because when you're having a factual dispute, it keys back to what the legal size of the contract requirement was.
There can be a potential legal issue, but I think in a lot of cases it's going to be a pure factual issue, just as in GTSI and Spectrum. I think you can say safely those were pure factual issues.
The difficulty I have with your saying that is that by definition, every delivery order is built on the underlying contract because it's the underlying contract that authorizes the delivery orders. You cannot have a delivery order contract that doesn't basically incorporate the underlying contract by definition. So that every time there's going to be a dispute about a delivery order, unless the dispute is, did you use pink paper? I don't know how often that dispute comes up. But I would think you all would be concerned about this problem because it's clear that that there's an enormous overlap between these two contracting officers. And do you really want them to go to both in order to protect themselves? Is that the system?
No, our preference is that they go to their ordering activity first. And that in these rare instances where they don't get a decision and they think there might be a legal interpretation issue, then to ask for a referral or to check with GSA first. But I agree with Mr. Weibel in one sense, and that's that there must be a category of cases that the ordering activity contracting officer is authorized to decide.
Clarify one thing. Trump says in his brief that it was impermissible for it to go to the GSA contracting officer, so like it's against the law. As Sharp interprets this regulation, 84066, they say the law requires me to go only to the delivery order contracting officer. I can't go anyplace else. Now, I didn't see you in your brief come back and give him any comfort Are you prepared to tell us today that a contractor in this circumstance is free always to go to either the GSA contracting officer or the DO?
Yes, that's correct. There's no prohibition on going to the GSA contracting officer. And indeed, under the pre-2002 version of the regulation, this was a situation that few boards of contract appeals encountered, and they said, it's your job to make sure you have proper jurisdiction before going to a board. So if you don't get, it's your responsibility to make sure you go to that GSA contracting officer. And there were numerous situations. We cited the Centennial and Grant cases where the ordering activity would issue a final decision, contractor would appeal it, and then the Board of Contract Appeals would say, it's incumbent on you to go to GSA because that ordering activity never had the authority to issue a final decision.
Well, the problem is simpler where there's one contract board you would go to regardless of which contracting officer you went to. We saw one of those cases where the party in question wasn't quite sure, so he filed with the EEOC case. So they filed both with the EEOC contracting officer and with the GSA contracting officer, lost both, appealed both, and then it was one of them got themselves kicked out.
Right.
But our problem of this dancing around is greater when there's more than one contract board you have to go to.
No, that's correct. And again, I do think there's an easy way forward, and that easy way forward is to file with your ordering agency first. And I think these deans now are aware this regulation's been in effect for a decade now, and this is the first case that we've seen on it,
or at least that's not the first case. There are four or five cases.
No, but in terms of a dean denial. So this situation is rare, and I think in this situation, a contractor has a few options. They can do what Sharp did, but they can also go and check with the GSA contracting officer to determine whether or not they feel that
there's a legal interpretation. You think the dean denial what triggers this problem? Ordinarily, the DO would make some sort of decision that people could then act on?
Exactly.
He'd refer it if it involved the base contract.
That's exactly right. I think this situation where the ordering agency contracting officer does not act does put the contractor in a difficult position.
Is it beyond our authority to take deemed denial out of the ballpark in these settings? Deemed denial sounds a little radical, but I mean, one way to solve this problem is to say, well, in a situation where you have a GSA contract and then you have a delivery order underneath it, in that setting, and we can define those settings very easily, we say when a claim is filed with a contracting officer, he cannot do a deemed denial. He must answer.
That's a matter of interpreting this regulation.
Right.
The issue, though, is that if we don't do it,
why don't you do it?
Well, the problem, though, is that there's a jurisdictional issue here in that the Army contracting officer, any decision that he or she issues, if that dispute related to the terms and conditions of the schedule contract, any decision that contracting officer issues is a legal nullity. The Army contracting officer is not empowered to issue any sort of decision.
What we're assuming was that instead of getting a deemed denial, the Army contracting officer here should have said, hey, you're in front of the wrong guy. This involves interpreting the GSA contract. Go on over there.
Right, that's exactly right. And the issue is when that doesn't happen, what is the contract?
Yeah, and so I was saying, well, why don't we just make him always make that decision?
I'm sorry.
Why don't we just make the contracting officer make that decision? Say you don't get to do a deemed denial. Not one of your options.
I don't know that we have any particular objection to it. I just don't know how that would work.
When this went before the Army Contracting Board, wouldn't that have been a good opportunity for the government to say, hold it, let's go back and start over? Rather than say, no jurisdiction.
Well, I'm not sure that an election that's within the government's options. I think that's actually an option that Sharp has to say, board, let's take this back to the Army contracting officer. But once the Army contracting officer doesn't act, the CDA says that's a deemed denial. So we can't take away that deemed denial. Sharp certainly could have, but we couldn't do it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gerber.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Weibel, you have 2 minutes. Let me ask you, when you got this decision from the BCA here, why didn't you just say, okay, we don't care. We'll go over to the GSA contracting officer. You tell us that's where we go. Let's do it.
Precisely because of the question that Judge Clevenger raised, which is how do we stop these cases from happening? We deal with this all the time. And it's incredibly unpredictable. In this case, we had two competent legal counsel who agreed. They looked at the facts. They looked at the law. They said, we're in the right place.
So all you want is certainty.
We want some certainty. And I'd like to briefly say that...
I mean, your brief, certainly, I applaud you for your creativity. Your brief says you'd like certainty, you'd like to have deemed jurisdiction, if you will, in a situation like this.
Well, I'll leave that for the brief, Your Honor.
I think you have certainty from this discussion. The certainty is that you better go to both contracting officers to cover yourself.
Well, and I would submit that is an unreasonable...
You could have cured your problem here. Right.
By going to the GA.
Sure. I mean, I realize you came here for your client, and the client's willing to pay to try to get a ruling that's going to help clear all this up. But you, for less money, you could have cured your client's problem by just going to GSA contracting officer.
Well, I think it would have had
the GSA contracting officer. You don't like the GSA contracting officer?
We have no problem with the GSA contracting officer. I just want to briefly, in the few moments I have remaining, say that this question has been resolved by the ASBCA in prior decisions, specifically the Spectrum Resources case. That's not a fact question. The issue there was, can the ordering activity contracting officer apply termination standards on the GSA schedule? The answer to that question was yes. Again, in the GTSI case, same question. Can they apply termination clauses of the GSA schedule to the facts of the case? And both said yes and I was at home.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank both of you.